Today is Monday, December 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Washington says it's ready to talk with Pyongyang despite an end-of-the-year deadline from North Korea.
The United States does not have a deadline. We have a goal to fulfill the commitments the two leaders made during their historic summit meeting in Singapore.
And what could a Senate trial look like as the House looks to pass articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump this week? Those stories and more are next. A senior U.S. diplomat on Monday urged North Korea to stop its provocations and re-enter nuclear negotiations. The comments come just ahead of Pyongyang's end-of-year deadline for nuclear talks. VOA's Bill Gallo starts us off.
It's not too late for North Korea to engage in nuclear talks. That from Steve Biegun, the top U.S. envoy for North Korea, who's visiting Seoul this week.
Let me be absolutely clear. The United States does not have a deadline. We have a goal to fulfill the commitments the two leaders made during their historic summit meeting in Singapore.
In recent weeks, North Korea has issued almost daily warnings about its end-of-year deadline for the U.S. to soften its stance on nuclear talks. North Korea has threatened to deliver an ominous Christmas gift, saying it's up to the U.S. what kind of present it will get. Biegun called those comments regrettable.
Let me speak directly to our counterparts in North Korea. It is time for us to do our jobs. Let's get this done. We are here, and you know how to reach us.
Biegun's trip to Seoul comes days after North Korea conducted two tests, apparently of engines for long-range missiles. There are fears the North could soon resume long-range missile tests. The moves have intensified concerns that major tensions could return to Korea in 2020, possibly derailing nearly 2 years of diplomacy between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
Now for more analysis on North Korea's actions and in the region, we're joined via Skype by Bruce Klinger, Senior Fellow for Northeast Asia at the Heritage Foundation. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me back.
So I wanted to get your reaction to Mr. Biegun's statements in Seoul that the United States is still ready for talks despite these recent tests at the Sohae launch facility.
Well, it's very consistent with U.S. Statements, not only during the Trump administration, but really preceding administrations. As much as Washington is often criticized for being unwilling to speak with North Korea, it's always been Pyongyang that's been unwilling to meet with our diplomats, or even now, North Korea saying they don't even want to have another summit meeting with Trump. So Mr. Biegun is trying to affirm that we remain open to diplomacy and negotiations, though he didn't mention it now. He's repeatedly emphasized that the U.S. position is not all or nothing, that we are looking for, you know, a flexible action for action. So really the ball is in North Korea's court, as it has been for years, if not decades.
What do you see taking place between now and the end of the year? Kim Jong-un has teased a Christmas surprise for the president and the United States. What do you think that may look like?
Well, I think all the expectations are that they're going to go up the escalation ladder. That they do that either to make a point or to affirm their military capabilities, or sometimes as a way of trying to induce greater negotiation flexibility or concessions from their opponents, whether it's the U.S. or South Korea or others. So whether it's on Christmas or New Year's Eve or thereafter, we're expecting they're going to go up the ladder. It could be either all of a sudden jumping to an ICBM or nuke test, or I might think they try to incrementally go up the ladder with a medium range test, a submarine launch ballistic missile test, an intermediate range test, perhaps even a provocation in the West Sea.
Now, there is some uncertainty as regards to what North Korea's next action may be. But one thing that also took place over the weekend is that Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe made an overture to South Korean President Moon Jae-in to meet while the three of them, Chinese President Xi Jinping, are all together in China during the next few weeks. What do you make out of that overture from Prime Minister Abe?
Well, we hope it gets traction. Obviously, the relation between our two critical allies in Northeast Asia is very strained right now over a number of issues. South Korea pulling out of a comfort women agreement and a military intelligence sharing agreement with Tokyo, as well as Japanese export controls. So far, the meetings between diplomats from the two countries haven't really made any resolution. But the U.S. is very concerned about strained relations between South Korea and Japan at a time when really the three of us need to be shoulder to shoulder confronting not only the North Korean but also the Chinese threats.
Now, you also partnered with some other individuals from think tanks and authored an op-ed on SMAs. Can you tell us really briefly about what you three said?
Right. Well, I think it's pretty unprecedented having the Heritage Foundation, the Brookings Institution, and the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the three biggest U.S. think tanks, in agreement. What we're arguing is that the Trump position of demanding an exorbitant increase in South Korea's contribution to the cost of having U.S. forces stationed in South Korea is incorrect. It turns alliances from value and tradition-based relationships into really transactional, and that's wrong. The logo for the Combined Forces Command between the U.S. and South Korea is Kachi Kapshida, which is we go together, not we go together if we get enough money for it.
Bruce Klinger is a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation for Northeast Asia, joining us via Skype. Thank you very much for your time today.
Well, thanks very much, Steve.
The U.S. House Democrats are one big step away from impeaching U.S. President Donald Trump. After 14 hours of contentious partisan debate, the House Judiciary Committee on Friday approved formal charges alleging Trump abused the power of his office and obstructed congressional efforts to investigate him. Should the whole House approve the articles of impeachment, President Trump's case would then move to the Senate, where Republicans hold a majority of the seats. Now, to help us understand what the process is, what it may look like, we're joined on the phone by Joel Paul. He's a professor at the University of California Hastings Law School. Joel, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Steve.
So before we get to the Senate and what a trial may look like, the House Judiciary Committee released a report of its findings ahead of the full floor vote. What's your reaction after taking a look at it?
Well, the House Judiciary Committee's report goes a little bit beyond the two counts that the House Judiciary Committee passed on Friday. The House Judiciary Committee has filed two articles of impeachment, one for abuse of power, the other, as you said, for obstructing a congressional investigation. The report itself actually reads into the abuse of power two other charges of specific criminal conduct by the president. First, that the president engaged in soliciting a bribe, which is a violation of federal law, and related to that, violations of the Wire Fraud Act because he used the telephone in order to in furtherance of his bribe. So what the Democrats, I think, are responding to here is the Republican charge that neither of the articles of impeachment themselves constitute a criminal act and therefore are not impeachable.
Right, and there was also some discussion last week that there were so few articles of impeachment, and as you said, there were no crimes. As expected, this week, the full House is going to take a vote on formalizing the impeachment process. If those articles of impeachment are passed, the president is not removed from office, but then things move over to the Senate, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has already started the negotiation process for what the Senate trial may look like. And I'm wondering if you could really briefly explain the whole process of setting up a trial in the Senate.
Sure. The first point is that the Senate is going to have to vote on the rules for the trial. They could use the same rules that were used in the Clinton case, which I think most people would agree were quite fair, that those rules were approved unanimously by the Senate, except that the Senate Majority Leader McConnell has said that he's going to coordinate with the White House, which suggests the rules are not intended to be impartial, but rather are intended to be in favor of the president.
Does that present a problem since the senators are, in fact, the juror of the Senate trial?
It does present a problem in this respect. The senators take a formal oath that they will do impartial justice, and this would seem to run contrary to that oath of office. On the other hand, people understand that the senators have partisan interests at stake here. What Senator Schumer is trying to do is to basically call the Republicans' bluff. The White House has said that they want to call as a witness the whistleblower and Hunter Biden and possibly Vice President Biden. And so Schumer is saying, well, if you want to call witnesses, we're going to call witnesses too, like John Bolton and Mick Mulvaney, which the White House certainly does not want to have testify.
And then what role does the Supreme Court play in a trial? Really briefly, we have about 30 seconds left.
Sure. The Chief Justice of the Supreme Court will sit as the presiding judge. He can rule on motions and decide on things like the relevance of evidence, but any of his rulings can be overturned by a majority vote of the senators.
Joel Paul is a professor of law at the UC School of Law at Hastings campus. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
U.S. Defense Secretary Mark Esper, in remarks at the 75th anniversary ceremony of the Battle of the Bulge, says it was that battle which stopped Adolf Hitler's last-ditch effort to turn the tide of World War II.
On a bitterly cold morning, 75 years ago, the snow-covered Ardennes Forest shook from the artillery bombardment that marked Hitler's final attempt to push back Allied forces from Germany's border.
Esper noted that the odds were against the Allies' forces.
The Nazis' rapid penetration and the corresponding bulge in the battle lines that ensued threatened to divide the Allied forces and possibly turn the tide of war.
He added that the United States was willing to commit everything to preserve freedom and to protect their way of life.
And on this ground, where the outcome of the Battle of the Bulge hung in the balance, American troops fought and forged an incredible victory that assured Hitler's defeat.
The Afghanistan Presidential Palace says the U.S. and Afghan government have agreed on a 4,000 U.S. troop withdrawal during General Mark Milley's recent visit to Kabul. A deputy presidential spokesman has told VOA that the troops' withdrawal is not linked to Afghanistan's peace process. A source who does not want to be named says the withdrawal will start within 3 months and it will be based on the Afghanistan ground realities. President Donald Trump's administration will announce the drawdown of more than 4,000 troops from Afghanistan soon, according to various U.S. news reports. Now for more, I earlier spoke with VOA's Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad.
I approached, officials in Afghanistan, in the Afghan government, and also the military, the U.S. military stationed there. And what they told me is quite interesting, that a presidential spokesman, a spokesman for the Afghan president, told me that this is an issue that has been under discussion between the Afghan government and the U.S. government on the fate of American forces in Afghanistan, and that recently both the sides in principle agreed that 4,000 troops could leave in a gradual way Afghanistan. And then, obviously, when I approached the U.S. military spokesman, I was told that they have not received any orders about reducing the level of troops in Afghanistan. We still are waiting for some kind of a version from the White House or Pentagon whether this troop drawdown is in the pipeline. But it comes at a time, when we have these negotiations taking place between the Taliban and the U.S. Teams in Qatar, although they are currently temporarily have been paused. But this has been one of the issues, like the withdrawal of foreign forces from Afghanistan has been one of the issues on the table, because that's what the Taliban want before they cease hostilities in Afghanistan.
You mentioned the peace talks with the Taliban taking place in Qatar, but this is also coming after the Afghan papers, and the United States officials cited in those papers saying that there was unclear and uncertain pathways to victory in Afghanistan. What are they saying more broadly about the United States' presence in Afghanistan?
It's a very complex situation, especially in the wake of these Afghan papers, that if the war has been facing challenges, I mean, if the United States and allies have not been able to break the stalemate that has persisted for the last 2 years, then obviously the only way out or to bring an end to this war, as President Trump has been, repeatedly saying, is through negotiation.
Ayaz Gul reports out of Islamabad. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Science in a Minute.
Data from a recent flyby of Jupiter by NASA's Juno spacecraft enabled mission investigators to discover a new cyclone near the planet's south pole. According to the scientists, the new storm is as big as the U.S. state of Texas. Shortly after arriving in 2016, scientists noticed that there were five large windstorms circling and forming a pentagon pattern around a central storm in Jupiter's southern polar region. This newly formed cyclone joins the five outer storms to expand the pattern from a pentagon to a hexagon. For the flyby, Juno was sent down to an altitude of only 3,500 kilometers above the gas giant's cloud tops. The Juno team also had to come up with some innovative measures during the flyby to keep the solar-powered spacecraft from going through what they say could have been a mission-ending eclipse. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Fighting in Libya continued over the weekend after Khalifa Haftar, Libya's de facto eastern leader, announced that he called a final assault on the western capital of Tripoli. But VOA's Heather Murdoch reports analysts say neither side of Libya's war is likely to have a decisive victory as international actors intensify their support for the warring parties.
On Friday, Khalifa Haftar, the strongman who leads Libya's eastern military, announced a final assault on the western capital, Tripoli, after nearly 9 months of battling to take over the city. Tensions quickly escalated as both sides anticipated ratcheted up international support for their enemy, with Russian troops believed to be supporting Haftar's army, known as the Libyan National Army, and Turkey promising to send forces to support the Western Government of National Accord if requested. Fighting continued throughout the weekend, but by Sunday afternoon, neither side had gained a significant amount of ground. Media supporting Haftar's forces claimed they entered part of Tripoli's city center, while locals inside Tripoli said although they heard airstrikes, they didn't see any of Haftar's forces, and fighting remained confined to the suburbs. Government of National Accord officials also claimed a degree of victory, saying they had retaken some ground. Analysts say Libya is stuck in a standoff, with neither side having a significant military advantage or recognizing each other as legitimate. Haftar supporters are saying Tripoli fighters are extremist militias, while in Tripoli, locals and officials say Haftar is a strong man who aims to be a new Libyan dictator. I'm Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Tunis.
More than 2,000 government, UN, and business leaders, as well as representatives from civil society and humanitarian agencies, are gathering to attend the first-ever Global Refugee Forum. Lisa Schlein reports that the three-day event, which opens today in Geneva, aims to generate new approaches and long-term commitments to help refugees and the communities that host them.
Organizers of the forum will be rolling out the red carpet for heads of state from Germany, Turkey, Pakistan, Costa Rica, Ethiopia, Somalia, as well as other prominent individuals who will be arriving for this seminal event. Much is at stake. More than 70 million people worldwide are forcibly displaced by war, conflict, and persecution. Among them are over 25 million refugees who have fled across international borders and are unable to return to their homes. homes. The UNHCR says it hopes this gathering will prove to be a game changer in the way refugees and the countries and communities that host them are treated and supported. UNHCR spokesman Babar Balosh tells VOA the world's piecemeal approach in dealing with displacement and refugee affairs has to change.
This is bringing everyone together at the same place on the same table, but also trying to work out a way forward in terms of how we deal with displacement issues. It is a clear call of responsibility sharing.
Balosh says everyone at all levels of government, development, financial, civil, and other sectors of society has to take responsibility and play a role in caring for the well-being of refugees.
It is about changing policies towards refugees. It is about responsibility sharing with the world's largest refugee hosting nations, like pledging more places for resettlement. But it is also changing policies, including refugees in education, in health services, and other sectors where they can benefit like other people.
The private sector also has an increasingly important role to play in responding to the growing needs of refugees. The UNHCR reports more than 100 companies and foundations, including big global corporations such as IKEA and Lego, are attending the forum. It says these enterprises are set to make pledges around jobs, finance, and other assistance. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations' longest climate talks ever ended in Madrid on Sunday, with countries agreeing to increase carbon-cutting commitments next year, but postponing clear-cut decisions in key areas. Lisa Bryant reports that critics accuse several of the world's biggest polluters, including the United States, of blocking progress in addressing a growing climate crisis.
There was some progress and compromise. The European Union, with the exception of Poland, pledged this past week to reach net zero emissions by 2050. Delegates agreed to enhance emissions cutting plans, but they failed to agree on clear targets, rules for carbon markets, or financing for poorer nations to adapt and respond to climate change. That adds pressure for next year, when the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement begins to be implemented. Here's a reaction from Costa Rica's delegation.
We did not quite get there this time, but we have progressed. As many others have expressed, we are disappointed that we once again failed to find agreement.
The talks were backdropped by a series of alarming findings on the growing impact of climate change on our oceans, forests, and glaciers, even as greenhouse gases continue to rise to record levels. Critics accuse big emission countries like Brazil, Australia, and the United States, which is set to leave the climate pact next year, of blocking progress in Madrid. As the talks overshot their Friday deadline, frustrated activists dumped manure outside the conference center.
What we're seeing coming out of these talks right now should set off alarm bells.
David Waskow is International Climate Director for World Resources Institute, a Washington, D.C.-based environmental think tank.
The biggest emitters are not moving at the pace and scale that they need to get us on track for a safe world.
World Wildlife Fund also accused a number of big polluters of holding the talks hostage, saying their position sharply contrasted with science, real-life evidence, and rising calls from the street for more climate action, especially from young people. Earlier in the week, Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg accused countries of clever accounting to get around emissions cuts. Speaking to delegates as the Madrid talks wrapped up, another youth leader, Sofia Mulvik from Norway, urged leaders to do more.
And youth are finished being your inspiration. Please use our solutions. Take the right decisions for our future and for all the people suffering the consequences of climate change today.
She urged countries not to let young people down. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Vunganyi, engineer John Dryden, and managing editor, Kate Pound Dawson, thank you very much for spending part of your day with us. You'll be able to find in-depth coverage of world events and news on the VOA News website. And don't forget, With our mobile application, you can download our stories and take them with you anytime, day or night. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.